Well, welcome back to another episode of Dissecting Popular IT Nerd. Your host, Mike Kelly, and today we've got Tom Schock, who is the director of IT over at Shepherd Electric Supply in Annapolis, Maryland. So, Tom, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? Tell us a little about your history and why you consider yourself a nerd or a geek.
Sure thing. So, I am the director of IT at a mid-market wholesaler of electrical supplies. Shepherd Electric has 7 locations in the Maryland, Virginia, Washington, D.C. region. We have about 350 employees, and we have about $500 million per year in revenue. So, you know, my expertise is really in the overlap between cybersecurity and mid-market. You know, I've been in the mid-market space for better part of 20 years at 3 different companies, all distributors of some sort. So, you know, the experience of addressing cybersecurity at those companies has just given me an insight into what that's like, because it is different. You know, there are challenges for mid-market companies when they try to address cybersecurity, but then there are also some things that make it a little easier. And those are the kind of the things I'd like to highlight as we talk through our session today.
Yeah, you know, with my experience, I didn't have experience at multiple organizations, but I was at a mid-market and I helped them grow through quite a bit. They were emerging or getting to that emerging side of enterprise. And, you know, we were up to like 40 locations, 8 different lines of business and everything else. And I am going to make the assumption that the challenges that you're talking about is the fact that they're not one of the big guys and they don't have the big budget to be able to just go buy all of the shinies. But the advantage that the mid-market has compared to some of those big guys is their agility and their ability to quickly address multiple things and or to have immediate access to those different things. Everything's not so segmented into different silos that you have to go make sure that this head of the silo and that head of the silo and that head of the silo all agree so that you can implement MFA across the organization. You could just say, you know what, we've got to do this because we're doing cyber insurance and too bad.
Yeah, I think certainly, and when I speak of mid-market, I'm, you know, talking about companies where, you know, certainly less than 1,000 employees, typically a couple hundred, sometimes even less than that. And it's really that size that creates the challenge that you were alluding to, and that you don't have a security team. I don't have a chief information security officer. You may not even have a member of your team that is dedicated to cybersecurity. So what you end up with is, as we have at Shepherd, a group of generalists who need to provide application support and infrastructure support and cybersecurity, you know, all at the same time, you know, sometimes in the same hour, you know, kind of just changing hats as needed. The flip side is what makes it a little easier, what works in our favor, is that a company of that size, you know, I know all our users, many of them by sight. So when you think about securing something, you know, kind of like, you know, we're and in the mid-market, we're trying to keep a, you know, a small house kind of secure and safe compared to like a large resort. You know, how much easier that is, because I recognize all the people walking in the door. You know, I don't need to rely on a key card system or a, you know, anything, a code system. You know, it's like recognize each person's face, know my name, and it's similar on the IT front. And that's what I think makes the mid-market unique, because the solutions that we are looking for or can deploy, really and often we can leverage that familiarity and that size benefit. Because the fact of the matter is, most mid-market companies aren't going to scale up to, you know, 5,000 users, you know, 1 billion in sales. They've been in the mid-market for sometimes 30, 40 years. And that's, you know, it's a great size, usually family-owned, and that's probably where they're going to stay. So they just need to find a way to secure that footprint And, you know, and I think that's where I had some experience and can offer some thought.
And so, you know, it for sure, that's one of those areas that, that people, that group definitely needs that help and that guidance. Where do you think is the best place to start with? Because typically, you know, we've got, you sent me some ideas before the podcast on topics, and you've hit on all of the primary ones to go with, but which one's the first one to go with? Where do we start this journey, and why they're first?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And, you know, cybersecurity is right now, it's incredibly wide and incredibly deep. And if you're starting from scratch, it is absolutely overwhelming. It's really difficult now because it's sometimes hard to even categorize a solution provider. Are you a car, a boat, or a plane? Because, you know, so many of the solution providers are kind of like, well, we actually can do all three of those. And that's just very confusing when you're shopping. You know, but I would say the first place that I have always started has been with an endpoint detection or response solution. And there's probably three of them, four of them out there that are, you know, top tier. And those are, there really isn't a difference between buying one of those for a 5-person shop or a 5,000, you know, endpoint shop. You know, they're all kind of built to do the same thing, and for the most part don't require a lot of specialization. So you can off the shelf implement, you know, just to throw out names, CrowdStrike, SentinelOne, Windows, Defender. I think Sophos has an EDR solution. And, you know, Carbon Black was certainly one of the pioneers in that area. And I think still, you know, provides that solution as well. But that's, I think, always a good place to start because it, you know, it's kind of like, you know, absent that, you've got a big gap in your security posture. So,
so what about the innate one? Or, you know, you mentioned Windows Defender, but then there's Windows Endpoint Protection. And so what about the innate versus, especially if you're a 5-person shop versus the 500 or the 5,000 user shop?
Yeah. And I take responsibility for probably misnaming with Microsoft products, yeah. But I feel like they share a little bit of responsibility there because they keep changing names.
Yes, they do.
And they rename everything. So when I think, you know, Microsoft, I'm talking about their EDR products. So if it is currently called Endpoint Detection, then let's go with that. Yeah, I don't think the built-in firewall, while, you know, I'm sure it has utility, I don't think it has the breadth and capability set that a, you know, top tier EDR solution provides. You know, all those, the ones that I mentioned are cloud based in that you can, you know, access the telemetry from the machine, you know, on a cloud, you know, portal, and really all they need is some form of internet connectivity, which is kind of ubiquitous now. It's a gift.
Yeah, yeah. There's not too many places, especially in the mid-market, that need air-gapped computers.
Nope.
If anything, they need, they have to have that internet connectivity to be able to get their email.
Yeah. I think, you know, and that mid-market is also far more likely to have some type of legacy, you know, maybe homegrown component that they need to, they can't decommission or turn off. And that's going to introduce more complexity to their cybersecurity posture than, you know, kind of a bigger company that can, you know, again, do like air gap, this, that, and the other. And so I think understanding that and recognizing, hey, there are some things that, yeah, you can't change it. If you're running a home built product that, you know, Lord knows what its operating system is, and it's no longer, you know, been decommissioned by the, you know, vendor for a long time, it's not providing security updates, then that may be a fact of your life. And you just need to kind of build your security posture with that, you know, understanding in place. It doesn't mean you can't become more secure. You might not ever pass a, you know, one of the NIF framework.
800.
Yeah. But that's probably okay because you're also not going to be required to do that by, you know, any kind of, you know, outside entity.
Attention all of my IT leaders. who don't know a lot about telecom. Many of you are still managing a pile of junk and you've inherited a telecom silo. I call it a telecom time bomb. Many of us are ignoring it because the enormity of tasks surrounding a phone system replacement is overwhelming and there's a constant barrage of direct sales reps trying to get you into a new UCaaS system today. And the whole process ends up being filled with an unforeseen comedy of errors. However, for those of you tackling such a task, you must answer, number one, are you going to go Microsoft Teams or are you going to do something else? If it is Teams, then there's only three ways to do it. And the worst way is by just clicking the button and paying that expensive voice enabling Teams button in your CSP's portal or asking them to do it for you. Okay, so you're not 100% sold on Teams yet because your company has a unique group of end users. Good for you for caring. Then you may be wondering, and you need to answer all these questions. Which platforms and interfaces have easy to self-manage portals, GUIs, so that you can make moves, ads, and changes on the fly? Which platforms are the most upgradable and have functioning APIs who will truly interoperate with your systems? Who's going to give you free equipment and headsets, of course, and be the most cost-effective? Who's going to support your team the best with fast technical support in minutes, not days? And who's going to meet your compliancy requirements now and in the future with flexible user licensing? How about network preparation, ensuring quality of and properly layering voice applications? How do you confidently ensure a smooth cutover and avoid going in with your fingers crossed? How do you negotiate all the legal ramifications of FCC regulated SLAs that affect your terms and conditions? Things like elasticity clauses and out of contracts if they fail to deliver. How do you know what your end users are thinking and how to deal with explaining technical to people 1,000 times that don't know how to do a transfer? And even if you have all this down, what do you do if you have limited time to research, evaluate, and confidently plan a network communications upgrade that will surely impress your key stakeholders with return on investment, CapEx, OpEx, all of this stuff? Evaluate and where do you get started in an ocean of vendors? Which provider mix is going to best fit your company's culture versus just asking your peers who they use or shopping VoIP.com or Googling who's the best and then you've got all kinds of people showing up in your inbox. This is why this is the classic put-off project where no one wants to take on the planning from start to finish. Everything from auditing bills to surveying staff, researching providers, sifting through information, meeting with vendors, requesting proposals, ensuring all the effective transition without outages, and managing all of the negative Nancy naysayers who are surely going to complain about the new phone system. Let me and my special team of telecom nerds give you all of the rollout maps, RFP grids, and hold you by the hand for free and even pit providers against them and give you all of the data information on what the lowest pricing has ever been with benchmark level pricing. Everything from seeing how far you can throw those old phone systems to every detail you need surrounding Microsoft Teams integrations or all of the best UCaaS providers with custom and in and out of the box APIs. Also, some of you are dealing with who's the best fit contact center software providers for your unique group of end users and agents and staff. How can you leverage AI software to drastically increase agent efficiency? And let's not forget about workforce management tools to ensure proper staffing, all while avoiding annoying meetings and sales reps telling you it's the end of the month, President's Day specials. All you need to do is email telecom@popularit.net and we will give you all of the information, everything you need, and hold you by the hand for free. And if you like the information, great, do whatever you want with it. And if not, you can tell us to go pound sand.
Yeah. You know, one of my friends had, and I know that it's a real popular saying anymore, if it's free, then you're the product.
Yeah, right.
So like the AVGs and those kinds of endpoint detection. And every time I'm trying to help somebody out and I find AVG or the free version of Symantec or, you know, all of those, I just cringe and just go, oh man, I don't know if I can trust this machine going forward.
Yeah, it is a challenge. And, you know, but EDR really isn't terribly expensive. It's usually pretty simple to deploy. You know, people who are supporting an environment, you know, it's going to be in their wheelhouse. You know, it's going to be something they're accustomed to doing. And it doesn't really, you know, all of them are all the ones that I mentioned are fine products and that they're not going to, generally speaking, blow anything up. You know, yeah, obviously it always makes sense to do the wise thing and start with a one or a small sample machines and kind of ease into it just to make sure you don't have anything in your environment that looks very unusual to that solution and therefore it wants to, you know, quarantine it or shut it down. But once you get over that hurdle, I found that our EDR solution is very quiet. You know, we've got a couple hundred users and they most of them stick to their knitting. You know, they don't do anything wild. You know, they're coming in to kind of do their operations-oriented jobs, so it's kind of the same thing every day for them. And we just generate very few alerts. And I just think compared to a large enterprise where you just have a much wider spectrum of users, I just think the volume makes it you know, such that it's pretty manageable for
And then the cloud-based ones, the other benefit that you really get from those is the fact that not only is it looking at your environment, but it's
checking back in with the mothership, so to speak, and getting those updates of any of the new threats. And so it gets new definitions all the time. Mm-hmm. So even though, you know, it's not just the base of my five computers, it's the base of all of the consumers of the same product. So, yeah, you know, it's getting vision and all of that. So they finally started, those providers started leveraging their whole network ecosystem. All right, we got EDR covered. What's next?
So I think the next easiest thing is email security. I mean, the vast majority of people listening on the podcast probably are, you know, either Google or M365. Mm-hmm. I just don't think too many people run Exchange on-prem anymore.
You'd be surprised.
but I do think an email security solution is just the next easiest and most bang for the buck. Because that's another, you know, really frequent entry point for, you know, bad things. And if you've got an email security, you know, provider that's going to screen out, you know, the malicious messages or, you know, the messages from known good users that happen to be hacked and have a, you know, a bad file attached to them. It's just, again, it's, you know, layer number two, you've got the EDR kind of playing goalie, and now you've got email, you know, out in front as close to fence. And it just is the definition of a layered approach to security.
Yeah. And then, you know, the other critical one that has to come in here, and it's one of the ones that some organizations are making their living off of this, and others are just trying to do the best they can with what's being provided. But that now comes the education. Mm-hmm. You got to be teaching, because both of these products are focused on the end user. And so we've got to start educating, or we got to make sure that they're, you know, we're all hearing about cybersecurity, but, you know, what is it? What do I got to do with that? You know, hey, I just got that email from the CEO. He needs 5 Google certificates real quick. Get certificates and they fall for it.
Yeah. Well, I think, and that's, you know, I agree with you 100% that security awareness training, you know, really important. I think you'll find that a lot of the email providers, that is one of those situations where it's a plane and a car. They do both. You know, it's just a really easy place for them to tack on the, you know, that service. And there are some other standalones, you know, Know Before is probably the most common provider of awareness, security awareness training. But going back to that small footprint, you know, on the mid-market, the benefit of, you know, that's just not having a lot of people is everybody in my company knows our CEO. And first of all, they know he's highly unlikely to send an email asking them to do, you know what I mean? They just know him personally. And so, those type of, you know, there's a sweet spot for that kind of socially engineered attack. And the mid-market a lot of times is like too tight knit. You know what I mean? It's like, I just saw him in the bathroom. You know, and he's not going to send me an email to me to go buy him a gift card. So it helps. You know, it's one of those places where it helps to be small.
Yeah, it does. And, but it's also one of those areas where you got to, just as you're starting to grow and you get to the point of you don't recognize every face in the hallway, mm-hmm. You really need to start making sure that you're setting up those checks and balances of, hey, you know, an employee just sent that they want to change where their paycheck is being deposited. Call them, stop by, talk to them. Don't just send them an email and validate it. And don't just take a text message for gospel on it. You know, go talk to them and make sure that they actually ask for their paycheck to get rerouted. Yep. And especially if it's one of the executives who has a larger paycheck.
Yeah, I think what's changed is the kind of automation isn't the right word, but the simplification of malicious tools makes it really possible to target a company of any size in the US. I think, you know, if you flash back 10 years ago, you know, cybersecurity wasn't as easy to perpetrate as it is now. And so, you know, if you were going to spend all that time and effort, you wanted to kind of, you know, be elephant hunting. And now I think the tools are made incredibly, they're proliferated. And I mean, really, you know, there's just so much ease of access to become a cybersecurity perpetrator that really any company, any US-based company, regardless of its size, is now an equivalent target. Because if you, you know, hit 10 companies and you know, get 10 grand each from them, that's, you know, as good as elephant hunting and finding, you know, 100,000 pounds.
Yeah. Well, and one of the other things that, that I've really come to use that technical term, grok, is that, you know, the cost or the value of the US dollar in other countries makes this so profitable for certain countries to mm-hmm. really just go after it. You know, a $500 win to us is like, oh, God, I can't even bother calling somebody about it because they're not going to care about $500. But for some countries, that's an annual salary.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can get a couple of those done in a month, then yay. But if they can get a couple of those done in an hour and continue to go after it, then it becomes really, really profitable for them. So, you know, yeah, it's not, oh, I got to get the elephant that's going to get me $5 million. If I can just get, you know,
yep. 10
of those rabbits, then I'm fat and happy.
Yeah. And that's just, you know, we could complain all day, but that's, you know, the way the world as it is right now. You know, the U.S. just has a huge number of companies. I mean, think about, you know, everything from, you know, little lawn care providers to home improvement. To, I mean, just the list is almost endless. And to your point, you know, many of those, you know, $500 is an unpleasant, you know, experience, but it's not going to be a showstopper. But, you know, if their emails is inaccessible or their data is inaccessible or their network is down, you know, that's, you know, that is a showstopper.
Yeah. Well, and that's the difference between like the business email compromise, that mm-hmm. social engineering, and ransomware. Ransomware, they're hunting the elephants.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's the mindset, more of, okay, we're going to get the whole organization, not just like one individual, and get them to mess up.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, you know, I've been sitting in a IT director chair from 2011. So I guess it's a bunch of years. Don't do math in my head, but 10, 12. And it's certainly become, if I spent, you know, 5% of my time in 2011 worried about cybersecurity, I spend 35% of my time worried about cybersecurity now. It is a significant portion of my day. And, you know, I don't envision that changing. You know, perhaps at some point Shepherd will grow large enough where every company will have someone who just focuses on security. But for the foreseeable future, it gets as much of my time as our key applications or our structure. You know, certainly probably more than how much time I spend on budget and strategic planning.
So, with your experience at multiple organizations, what has been your experience with the other executives and their general stance on cybersecurity? Because I, you know, the organization that I was at the longest, it was kind of that necessary evil, like insurance, but they mm-hmm. were more willing to go after insurance than they were to invest in cybersecurity, because it was still this ethereal thing out there where either I was doing a good enough job that it wasn't a threat to them, or they just weren't really afraid of that. It's one of those things that you almost have to have that car wreck before you're worried about the car insurance mm-hmm. to really bring that home. How have you broached those conversations? Because I know that was always one of the challenges for me. And I've talked to a few people on our chairs that, and asked them how they approached it. And what's your approach?
So it was certainly a more challenging conversation 10 years ago and even 5 years ago. But I think the frequency of occurrence has made it a much easier sell. So in our market space, you know, again, we're a wholesale supplier of electrical components just in this region. Some of our competitors have had windows of time where they've been offline, and we'll get, you know, an influx of calls because, you know, so-and-so's down, and we come to find it with cybersecurity related. So, you know, one of those probably would have been sufficient. The fact that that's happened probably three times over the last 5 years to different entities in our area has made it such that, you know, if I go to our owner and say, hey, I really think we need to do X. You know, I have his full and complete attention because, you know, it was, you know, the 130 something year old family, you know, run business, and reputation is really material to him, you know, probably more so than the monetary concern, just the thought that he wouldn't be able to serve his customers because we were down because we're recovering from some type of cybersecurity incident. So that makes the discussion now, it's not so much of a sell, but it's more of a, okay, you know, we're not going to become the NSA. You know, we don't have that kind of expertise or budget. So what do we do? And how do we do it in a way that doesn't, you know, slow our speed of business or our customer service? Or degrade our user experience, because that's certainly not the objective. You know, you don't make money by having a great cybersecurity posture. That's not the way to fill up the, you know, be able to get paid. So we just need to be cognizant of that. And that's more where the conversation lives now than convincing them of an actual need to do something.
Yeah. Okay. EDR, email security, making sure the executives are aware, getting the end users trained and conscious at the very least of things. Next.
So I would, if you know, for me, the next one is patch management. So you've got devices, servers, and, you know, desktops plus laptops. Keeping them patched, I think, is fairly affordable. And I think, it, you know, a lot of times people are like, oh, I can do that myself, but it's more than just the operating system. You know, what you'll find is a lot of times there are vulnerabilities in applications that you just wouldn't think would be that big of a target. Adobe, no offense to Adobe, but right.
A target, so, they're an elephant.
Yeah. So the patch management solutions, and there are a number of them out there, they just provide you with that, you know, kind of list of, hey, here are all the remediations that are needed on the machines. And many of them, you know, you can kind of configure them to, you know, kind of knock that out on your behalf. And it takes a little getting used to. Our users didn't love it. You know, we got complaints that this thing wants to restart like every day now. And, you know, my response is, you know, again, I'm sorry that's the world that we live in, but most of those patches are security driven. And, you know, when you have 20 applications on your machine, plus the OS, plus M365, plus the firmware, yeah, there's going to be a lot of restarts in your life. That's the way it goes.
Yeah. And you probably need to be doing them a little faster. And if you haven't set up autosave, hey, it's what?
Yeah,
most everything has a version of autosave now, so that you can get right back to where you were.
It's true. It's true.
What other thoughts you got for us? What other?
So I think, you know, once you kind of have those four in place, you know, you've got EDR, you know, you've got email security, got the awareness training, and you're doing some, you know, you're patching your endpoints. Now it kind of becomes all right. You know your environment better than anybody else. So the exercise that I do with my team once a year is, you know, we have a kind of a purpose-built meeting for this. Is, hey, put on your hacker hat. If you were going to hack Shepherd, what would you do? How would you, you know, break into this company? You know, some of my team members are better at others than kind of like flipping the script and coming up with, you know, ideas. But once, you know, as like, you know, people start throwing out thoughts, it kind of, you know, you get some traction there. And I generated, you know, a punch list that took me 18 months to clean up from their, you know, their input. And that includes everything from just physical security to, for instance, you know, historically we didn't have any type of barrier on our server room door. You know, I mean, it was a small company that grew to be a slightly larger company, and, you know, but that's the
closet.
Yeah. You know, and after a while people were like, well, hey, wouldn't it make sense, you know, even if it just seems like a cursory barrier, just to, you know, put something in, you're probably right. So those type of things can come out of that exercise, and some more complex thoughts. You know, it also helps you to kind of build your, hey, you know, what are our most critical assets? I mean, you kind of know that intuitively, but it just helps to kind of talk about that. It leads into that conversation. So, you know, my kind of three-pronged approach to, you know, cybersecurity is, you know, something's better than nothing. You know, it can be a little bit overwhelming, but, you know, that's always a good place to start. But then the kind of the part of where you really plan to be unsuccessful, expect that at some point in the next so many months or years, you're going to have a cybersecurity incident, despite your best efforts. So I believe it makes sense to make investments in that, you know, future failure in the form of some type of incident response plan. So, you know, it can seem like, well, gosh, that sounds expensive. And it's not inexpensive, but for a couple thousand dollars, you know, you could have an incident response retainer with a company who can help you, because it really is. I mean, again, I've been in this industry for a long time, but I am not a cybersecurity expert. You know, if you know, something is present in my network and it's, you know, encrypting files, I am not going to be the person to figure out what that is, how to remediate it, what steps do I need to take, where did it most likely originate. You know, all of those types of activities are really, you know, that is a specialist. And you want to know who that specialist is. You want to know what their number is. You know, you want to have that relationship in place so that when it happens, you know, your response is measured in hours and not days.
Yeah, because days means days of time that the organization is probably not working, or at the very least, they're not at 100%. So,
yeah.
So what about these other, well, not other, I mean, you've already talked about some of the as a service, mm-hmm. but now you blend in the cloud. Now we've taken away that hard exterior shell that we all used to love and, mm-hmm. and hide behind our firewalls. And now we've got roaming workers. We've got roaming hardware. We've got cloud services, not just as a service, but, you know, we've got virtual machines in cloud networks where most people are probably hoping aren't using private networks anymore. So MPLS and the like, and those dedicated expensive networks are gone. And now we're trying to all leverage direct internet access and internal VPNs to interconnect all of our sites. What levels of security, what are you doing in those realms? Or what advice do you have for somebody who's walking into this position, you know, has just gotten their director hat and is trying to take and evaluate, okay, where am I?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, Shepherd's a great example. When I first arrived 5 years ago in 2019, they were very traditional, you know, everybody in an office working. Maybe there were 5 laptops in the entire organization. And then COVID comes around and, you know, that changes everything. And we are now a fully hybrid organization. 170 of our users, pretty much anyone who could possibly work remotely has that capability, and almost all of them take advantage of it at least one day a week. So to your point, yeah, that's a totally different architecture, but it's not terribly difficult to set up. I mean, really any firewall product that you have, you know, whether it's a physical firewall or a virtual firewall, is going to have a secure socket, you know, or VPN, SSL VPN client that you can install on that remote endpoint. And that's going to create, you know, a secure tunnel between that endpoint and your network. And again, all of the kind of major players in that space, adding MFA to that, it's quite doable, not expensive, not complex. Our users are totally accustomed to it. They do MFA to get to their bank or their 401k or, you know, really anything now. So that was not a hard sell. So that's the space we currently live in. We have on all of our remote endpoints a secure socket SSL VPN client from our firewall vendor with MFA using an app on their smartphone. That being said, we are exploring the, you know, secure access service edge. There's so many different acronyms now, CASB, SASE,
yeah.
But essentially it is firewall on the cloud that you access, that you go to, and then that lets you go on to wherever else you're going to go, whether it be software as a service, you know, like Salesforce, or back to your network for your own, you know, on-prem ERP.
You know, I'm thankful, and I think I'm beginning to really start to see that consolidation, because you mentioned something about it in the beginning of the conversation, that cybersecurity wide and deep, but I think we're finally starting to see it kind of start to constrict again down to a limited number of critical products like the five that you've mentioned, but now we bring in SASE, we bring in CASB, we start bringing in, you know, the zero trust. Mm-hmm. And just having that correct posture and that thought of the protection of every individual endpoint. And I'm not even saying it the right way. I can't even think of a better way of saying it, but we're seeing that consolidation versus all of the different ways. I remember SASE when it was four individual things and versus the combined solution that it's becoming. It's almost becoming like that XDR is one of the other things that they love to throw out there too.
Yeah. And that issue, I agree with you that there is starting to become some consolidation. And also some of it, I think is, you know, because you need, you know, every IT leader spending more time in the cybersecurity space, they're becoming more familiar with kind of categorizing different vendors because, you know, as a vendor, you may want to be, you know, a car, boat, and a plane. But, you know, if really you're, you know, bread and butter, what kind of brought you to the dance is being a boat, everyone's pretty much going to kind of look to you for that activity. And then, you know, it just helps as you're evaluating the market space to kind of, you know, filter out all the acronyms, you know, EDR, XDR, MDR, how does all that mean? It's like, oh, well, really, there isn't that much, you know, they are different, but, you know, the core value proposition is a little bit simpler to digest. And then some of it's more like, you know, toppings on a taco, you know?
Salsa.
Right. Shredded cheese.
Well, yeah, I want my queso, yes. So, interestingly enough, one of the acronyms that you threw out there made me think of something else that a lot of people are pushing. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that. And that's the 24/7 coverage.
So we don't have 24/7 coverage. We did for a while. Most
markets don't.
Yeah, we did for a while on our EDR product. And to be honest, what we found is, and when we changed EDR products this past year, we took the opportunity to kind of reallocate those funds. And, you know, we went with one of the big players and we just basically implemented a really tight policy. I mean, it's all kind of sliders. We didn't have to like write any code or anything, but essentially we have our EDR set to anything it doesn't like, shut it down. Anything it definitely doesn't like, shut it down. Basically, you know, when in doubt, shut it down, because it's more feasible for my, you know, 6-person team to get a phone call, you know, once in a blue moon from a user that, hey, you know, I can't do anything. I think, you know, something's wrong with my laptop. And then to hop on the cloud portal and see that our EDR, you know, shut them down for, obviously, we shouldn't have been doing it anyway, than it is to pay for a 24/7 monitoring and to have a more permissive policy and rely on, you know, that, you know, vendor or managed, you know, security service provider to take action on our behalf. So we have two of our solutions are in that kind of same boat. Autonomous mode, super tight policy, whatever you don't like, shut it down and we'll deal with fallout. It's kind of our approach.
Have you seen anything with the artificial intelligence hitting yet? I mean, and yeah. Any direction? Let's talk about that for just a minute. And, you know, there's lots of topics around that.
Yeah. So our network monitoring solution was kind of born from AI. It's Darktrace. It's a, you know, fairly common solution now, but so that thing's whole approach to life is, you know, it's like the little old lady on the street who knows every neighbor and every car they drive and what their schedule is. So as soon as like Bob's driving a different car and gets home late, I mean, you know, that's just sets her a Twitter, you know, and that is exactly what Darktrace does. It, you know, it sucks in all this data and it pushes it up to the AI engine, and the AI engine just compares what's happening right now to what that MAC address has been doing for the last, you know, year of its life. And when there's something different, just shuts it down. It doesn't really, it's not smart. You know, it's not smart like a person would be smart and be like, oh, well, that's actually okay. And that's fine. That's all that we needed to do. But it is definitely an AI driven service product, even though we as a company, Shepherd, we don't, you know, don't have any real investment in AI at this moment. We certainly don't have any expertise in AI at this moment. But I can recognize, you know, of quality pumpkin pie when I see one, and I don't have to know how they made it to enjoy it. And that's what kind of what we're doing with our network monitoring tool.
What about on the flip side of that, though? Have you seen any AI or heard of any times that AI was leveraged as the attack mode? And because, in all honesty, I have yet to really hear of a big breach that they're touting being driven by some of the AI tools.
Yeah, I have not. So I think, you know, maybe that's one of those places where you really need that bespoke human component to be a quality hacker. You know, I think, you know, AI in general, I mean, we're looking at it pretty seriously from a productivity tool, not cybersecurity related, but just how can it augment our regular employees' lives to make them faster, easier, better, you know. And there's a couple different solutions there that we're exploring, all of them, you know, Microsoft, Zoom, you know, we're not doing anything terribly different from the rest of the market space. But yeah, I can't speak to why, you know, convergence of the kind of simplification or commoditization, you know, malicious actor tools and AI haven't become a bigger thing. But as you kind of mentioned, a lot of these providers have a big enough install base that, you know, they're sharing that telemetry from all of their customers. And I imagine it's not insignificant to, you know, try to slip one past the goalie there when you have that many, you know, that big of a sample size. You know, you come up with something new and inventive, and then all, you know, those tools kind of see it once, and then they share that knowledge with the other, you know, million endpoints running their product, and it becomes obsolete. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and so I have seen a little bit in this arena, kind of from the same side that you have, though, of the providers who are leveraging AI to make their product more full-featured and, you know, trying to, and I'm thinking of somebody in particular, but I'm not giving them the airtime yet. they're doing just like you were talking about of, you know, that the behavior analysis and the traffic analysis and the endpoint information and the log aggregation and just aggregating all of that data together to be faster on those shutdowns and those things. Or instead of waiting for the human to say, okay, I agree, this is bad, and push the button, it's going ahead and pushing that button. And I think it's doing it more of a surgical strike than, you know, I like to think of it with the cell phone. So you can either do the nuclear option and just brick the phone, mm-hmm. or if you're doing things properly, you've got that surgical strike and you can remove all of the corporate data while leaving the user data alone. So the new AI tools are doing the surgical strike of not just shutting down that whole laptop and segmenting them out of the network, but now they're like saying, okay, he's now suddenly talking and he's sending non-DNS requests on that DNS port. Let's shut down that DNS port from that machine and doing much more segmented approaches to things. Or laser approaches to things versus the big options. But I also know, and I've read somewhere about, you know, ChatGPT, Gemini, and what's the other one?
OpenAI.
Yeah. Well, ChatGPT. Oh, Copilot. Yeah, which is OpenAI. Two of those are the same. But there are hacker tools that they're building their own large language models to have their own AI tool for the attacks. So mm-hmm. as they get that initial foothold, then they're spreading faster or attacking faster. So their speed from infiltration to execution, or their cyber kill chain, I think is one of the ways that we talked about it. Mm-hmm. It's getting smaller and faster. And so we almost have to have the AI, or either that or all of the vendors are upselling it that way. You're going to have to, because humans are too slow. Back to the 24/7 conversation. You know, let's take a slight twist. Tell me some of the fun things in your career. What's one of those stories? What's one of those times that you just go, oh God, double facepalm? When you think about that either that trouble ticket, that time that executive walked into your office, or Nancy from accounting came yelling at you for something. What's one of those tickets?
Well, this is kind of cybersecurity related. I've been through a cybersecurity incident. It was, you know, not quite 10 years ago. So not early in the cybersecurity world, but early enough. And I just remember hopping on, I forget what I was doing, but I needed to hop on a Sunday night to do something pretty pedestrian. And all the files on the desktop for the server I jumped on, like, looked the same. And it's just that, you know, it's like that kind of thing when you've ever been robbed, where you walk into your house, you're like, well, that's not where that or that either, or that looks really odd. It just takes a moment to kind of, you know, for the reality to sink in that, you know, this is not going to be a fun night. And so, yeah, I remember looking at that, you know, the server desktop and being, well, that's really odd that all the icons are the same. And, you know, the thought I had was, you know, this is probably what a lot of what a cybersecurity incident looked like. And then, you know, lo and behold, there we are. so, you know, we survived, the backups held, you know, and I'd rather be lucky than good any day. I will say that, but it was a great experience in that I came out of there really in touch with how close I came and that organization came to, you know, having to pay the ransom, or, you know, it really could have been the end of that setup. Because, you know, at the end of the day, if you can't access, you know, your data, you know, it you're kind of done. And so, you know, and backups are really great, but, you know, everyone's had a situation in their career where a backup either didn't restore properly or restored, but something was a little bit amiss. So we haven't really touched on it, but I really lump backup and recovery as a cybersecurity layer now. I don't think of it as infrastructure. I think of it as a cybersecurity solution, and I put it in my cybersecurity budget accordingly. It doesn't go in the same budget as like server refreshes or that kind of thing. It goes in cybersecurity because that's almost certainly where it's going to get utilized. I mean, you know, we could get hit by a tornado or a train or a plane, but we're probably going to get hit by cybersecurity. That's probably where we're going to use it.
Yeah, and it is. It's critical. And then, so what are your thoughts about on-prem, off-prem, immutable? Talk a little about those.
So I am, I have been a Veeam customer forever, you know, just probably like 85% of the market space, but really became concerned just with the architecture of my implementation of Veeam, which was, I was running Veeam Backup and Recovery on one of my virtual machines. And it became clear just, you know, talking with, you know, attending conferences and just kind of staying up on the setup that architecture was vulnerable. So there were a couple options. I could either harden that Veeam architecture, which is absolutely a viable way to go, just so that you're not reliant on your vCenter, vSphere kind of setup to execute on your backup recovery, because that's not a great game plan in the event of a cybersecurity incident, because, you know, malicious actors kind of understand that. So once they're in your environment, kind of their game plan is, well, we're going to detonate this malware that's going to compromise your vCenter environment, either all the way down to the host or maybe just the vCenter server, at the same time that we encrypt your data. So it kind of, that setup, it, you know, encouraged me to reevaluate our backup architecture and kind of understand, all right, where, you know, what kind of situation are we going to be in if we really need to kind of start from scratch? And again, this is something that we did further on in our maturity, as, you know, putting our cybersecurity game plan together, because it was not an inexpensive investment. But we have backup hardware that's, you know, with a vendor that we can call and get essentially new ESXi hosts or Lumber ESXi hosts that we can run. And our backup and recovery solution is no longer associated or tied to or dependent upon our ESXi or VMware vCenter environment. It is completely separate. That was a long answer to your question of, yes, I have backups on-prem on hardened devices in the cloud and, you know, a third copy elsewhere, two of which are immutable. So, you know,
multi-copy, immutable.
Yeah. belt suspenders and a pair of shorts with a lot of coverage is kind of how you want to approach coverage.
All right. So, you know, I was trying to find one of those tickets that you got any other stories? You got something personal that what lit up in your eyes right then when I asked you that question? What's the story that's hidden behind that smile?
Well, I have to filter all the ones that are not appropriate for podcasts, which is a smaller subset. I think, you know, one of the pieces of information that I've found helpful is looking for solutions that provide like 80% of the value with only like 20% of the complexity. Because I think there are, you know, just like when you're shopping for a car, you know, there can be a car that, you know, has a bunch of bells and whistles. And yes, they are nice. But really, if you're just looking for basic transportation, you know, there's a model out there that can perform that function perfectly well. And it will be a little less expensive and a lot easier to maintain. And for crews of my size, the ease of maintenance is so important because on any given day, you know, we're stepping into, you know, helping someone with a printer or, you know, fixing a Wi-Fi access point. And then we got to step into one of our cybersecurity solutions. And it really needs to be intuitive, you know, because, you know, we just don't have the luxury of sending someone, you know, to a training seminar for that lasts a week long to become an expert in that product. We just don't have that headcount. So, you know, don't be afraid to say to a vendor, hey, you know, I like this architecture. I think it's a fine approach, but you're not the right vendor for us. You know, we're just looking for someone who can provide a comparable product with just a, you know, that is far less complex. You know, that's a legitimate response.
Yeah, especially for the mid-market, because there's a lot of times that they try to use that same approach of selling to trying to sell to the elephant and trying to sell to the rabbit.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work. So, you know, I was trying to think of something that I was going to ask you to give me an example of some of the technology that you grew up with that you don't think that somebody born after 2000 would recognize. What's something there?
So certainly, you know, I feel like the fax machine fits into that category. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day about Excel, and they were about my age, and we were talking about the slash key and Lotus 1-2-3, and like every command was, you know, a slash key, and then it was just, there just was no, it was all keyboard. And the other person in the room was, you know, they're probably in their 20s or something, and they were just, we might as well be like speaking Greek. They were like, what are they talking? But yeah, back in the day, you know, you had Lotus 1-2-3 and Harvard graphics and some type of, you know, email package that was not standard. I mean, every email package was like a, you know, blue mail or whatever. It was just, you know, yeah, totally different.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to Pine when we had to log into the Linux server, instantiate Pine so that we could then bring up the text-based emails and read through those. So I went to one of the AIs and I asked them for some examples of these. And I actually tried to flip the script a little bit and say, okay, give me 10 technologies that somebody born before 1980 wouldn't recognize. And the answer, I'm a text-based AI and can't assist with that. What? And all of the examples it gave are things that I think every one of us that was born in 1970 through 1985 would recognize. Smartwatches, wireless charging, cryptocurrency, virtual reality, augmented reality, smart speakers, streaming services, social media platforms like TikTok, cloud gaming, e-scooters, because, you know, we can't handle those. We can't handle a scooter that moves for us.
I think the test case for that is like a U.S. robotics modem. You know, if you showed somebody a U.S. robotics modem and they have, you know, used one of those in their professional life, that kind of tells you where they fall in the age spectrum.
Yeah. Well, you got any thoughts or anything else you want to share? Anything that you want to self-promote?
No. But I think, I think I mentioned the three-prong approach, but I've only said two of them. But again, a three-prong approach that I take to cybersecurity is it's definitely a journey, not a destination. You're never going to get there. So don't, you know, you got to kind of frame it that way. It's going to be a little bit demoralizing to feel like, oh my God, you know, we've done so much, but there's now there's like X, Y, and Z threat that we don't haven't addressed. And that's okay. You know, it's you do the best that you can. And kind of along those lines, it's, you know, again, something is better than nothing. So, you know, if you're just don't feel like you have the bandwidth or the capacity to take on any of the major solutions we mentioned, you know, you can Google and, you know, just take some actions on your domain controllers to, you know, make them a little more hardened. And that's better than doing nothing. And I think, you know, people will find that once they kind of get into that space, it's not quite as daunting as it seems. And then a lot of the solutions that come out have autonomous mode. And I am, you know, someone who wasn't, you know, was cautious about that. But now that I've utilized it on a couple of different platforms, I'm a big fan. I feel like it has utility and, you know, it has a place, particularly in the mid-market, to mitigate the need for 24/7 coverage, which is a big challenge for companies of our size.
Yeah, and I think things have gotten a lot better because I remember when I first started thinking about intrusion prevention systems, IPSs instead of IDSs, and being so afraid to turn that on because it was like one of the first products that was trying to use that autonomous mode and say, ooh, bad pattern, we're going to block this, and the ability to shut down a potential business activity was so scary back then. But now, you know, like just like MFA, people have gotten used to it, have been introduced to it in so many different places that autonomous mode and our ability to correctly identify things that should be shut down. Just like they recognize that the scams happening on our credit cards when those purchases being made are outside our norm, that they're calling you going, hey, are you really trying to buy tennis shoes after you just filled up the gas tank?
Yep.
So, yeah. So that's the three-pronged approach. It's a journey, not the destination. Something's better than nothing. And turn it on.
Yep. No test like production.
All right, sir. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for spending your time with us. We really appreciate it. Dissecting Popular IT Nerds and the audience appreciates your time and your dedication. And hopefully somebody learned something today. I know it's been an enjoyable conversation. So thank you for your time.
Well, it was a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.